we've been trying to do is to constrain the space of possible quantum field theories based on only fundamental principles of the S matrix. And these principles are analyticity, crossing, and unitarity. And of course, this idea of studying quantum field theory based only on these axioms is not a new one. It's one that was very popular and then very unpopular already many decades ago. And what's given us motivation to revive this ideology is progress in conformal field theories, where we've learned that exactly this type of question, what is the space of possible theories, is one that's very amenable to bootstrap techniques, okay, and has led to huge progress in CFTs over the last several years. And so we want to, you know, learn as much from our CFT compatriots and try and recycle their ideology for massive quantum field theories. Okay. So let me say more specifically what I mean by constraining the space of possible quantum field theories. So let's say I give you a theory with a fixed spectrum. Okay, and throughout this talk, I'm going to be talking about gap theories, which means my lightest particle, which will have mass m1, that mass is greater than zero. Okay. And I can have some other single particle states, m2, m3, and eventually they'll be at twice the mass of the lightest particle, the multi-particle continuum. Okay, and so of course these single particle states will have some interactions with each other. Right? You have some, in a generic theory, you'll have some cubic vertices. And I'll call these, I'll define these to be couplings, Gi, Jk. And the question is, given some mass spectrum, what is the space of possible couplings? Okay, and in particular, are these couplings bounded? So is there some upper bound on these Gi, Jk, which would of course then depend on the spectrum of the theory that you're assuming? Okay, so this is the question. And let me explain the intuition, why this is a natural question to ask. And the basic idea is that, let's consider a theory of scalars just so that the intuition is completely clear. As you increase these interaction strengths, okay, there's gonna be some attractive force between these particles that's gonna be increasing, right? And eventually, one of two things is gonna happen. Either you're gonna form a bound state, okay, from some of these particles, which means that basically a new particle will come in from the multi-particle continuum. Okay, and so modifying your spectrum, right? So already that would tell you, no, there's some, if you want a spectrum without this particle, there's already some bound on the coupling. Or there's another possibility, which is that you already have some bound state in your spectrum. Let's say M2, it could be a bound state of two M1s. And you're saying that you want that bound state at some fixed mass. Okay, but as you increase the interactions, the binding strength of that bound state is going to increase, and it may not be possible to have it at that mass anymore. We'll have to shift left, more tightly bound, okay? And this, of course, would modify your spectrum, right? Because you're saying, I know I want the theory with M2 here. Okay, so for these reasons, this is a very natural thing to ask, and basically the remainder of this talk will be to prove that it's true, and basically this proof follows from these properties of the S matrix. So, just to wrap up this little introduction, I want to mention that everything I'm going to say in this talk will be about 1+1 dimensions, but that a huge portion of it, especially all of the numerical parts and this intuition, is of course valid in higher dimensions, and you know, are just as able to get bounds in higher dimensions. Okay, that was the subject of this paper. I just don't want to talk about it today because I have new results. I mean, we have new results in 1+1 that I want to talk about. But I just don't want you to think that this is something highly specialized for 1+1. It's quite general. Okay. So let's now move to a warm-up, which will be basically the simplest example of these bounds, which is, let me consider a theory whose lightest particle is some chargeless scalar. Okay, so this is some, people use the word neutral scalar. And this amplitude defines some S matrix element, which I'll just refer to as S, which depends on the Mendelstam invariants. Okay, these are the invariants formed from the momenta of the external particles. And these, of course, satisfy the usual on-shell constraint that S plus D plus U equals 4m1 squared. But there's an additional constraint coming from kinematics of 1 plus 1 dimensional scattering, which is just that when you're in 1 plus 1, you can only scatter forward or backward. Okay. So that means that either t equals 0 or u equals 0, but because we're talking about identical chargeless scalars, those two processes are identical. Okay, so we can just by convention take u equals 0. Okay. So in combination with this constraint, this just tells you that t is equal to 4m1 squared minus s. Okay, and this S matrix can be reduced to a function of a single variable. Now we want to know what do these properties tell us about this function. Okay. So analyticity tells us that we have an analytic function of S up to some singularities that can come when you have intermediate states that go on shell and propagate for long distances. Okay, the canonical example of this is the cut which comes from two particle states. Okay, so in Feynman diagrams, it would come from a diagram that looks like this. You have a two particle state in the S channel. This results in this cut, which starts right at the two particle threshold, 4m1 squared. Of course, you have the same in the cross channel, right? From diagrams, the same diagram, but in the cross channel. This starts at 0. And in addition, if you have these sorts of single particle states in your theory, and they can appear in this process, they'll occur as poles below threshold in this S matrix. Okay. So since I want to consider the simplest example, I'm going to consider an example of an S matrix where I have only one pole. Okay, so I can only have one intermediate state. And this is essentially this picture without the M3. And now I'm just saying that I'm considering an example where there's some symmetry that's setting the self-cubic coupling to 0. Okay, so if I go to the position of these poles, if I go to the position of this pole, the amplitude will factorize. Well, it's easier to just draw it like this, actually. These poles, they come from, of course, processes like this. Right? So when I go to the position of this pole, the amplitude factorizes, and I get this twice this cubic coupling. These are the cubic couplings I introduced here. This is 1, 1, 2. And it's, of course, multiplied by the pole. So this, if you want, you can take this as the definition of these cubic couplings. They're the residues that occur when you go to these factorization poles in the S matrix. OK, so that's analyticity. Now I want to talk about unitarity. My chalk is up here, I guess. Well, no, sir, let's do crossing next. So crossing is just the simple statement for this case. It's actually crossing symmetry, that if you look at this process in the S channel, it's exactly the same process in the T channel. Okay, so this just tells you that S of S is equal to S of T, which is 4m1 squared minus S. Okay, so this is just telling you have some reflection principle, which is kind of obvious already in this picture. Okay, and finally, unitarity. Unitarity, for this case, in its weakest form, tells us that, well, so again, I've defined S as what I'm calling S here is S11 goes to 1, 1. And it tells us that this squared must be less than or equal to 1 for S, so this is now small s, the Mandelstam variable, physical. Right. This is just telling you that probability is conserved. The probability of going from 1 plus from 1 and 1 to 1 and 1 must be less than 1. You can go into other states, for example, like going from 1, 1 to 3 ones. Okay, and so the physical region is, of course, this. It's where you have enough energy to produce these external states. But then, using, for example, real analyticity, this also implies that you have this bound here, and then crossing implies that you also have this bound here. Okay. So now we have a very simple mathematical problem. We want to find how big can this residue be, right, given that you have a function with these properties. And the solution comes from this so-called maximum modulus theorem. So This maximum modulus theorem is just a simple property of complex functions of a single variable, and it tells you that if such a function has, if you take this function in some domain and you ask where are the maxima of its modulus, it must occur on the boundary of the domain. Okay? And so really we're in a perfect situation to use such a theorem, because you see that here we have an analytic function whose boundary, right, is here, it's the edges of these cuts, and we know that the function is bounded. Okay, so it's begging us to use maximum modulus theorem. There's just one caveat, which is that we need to remove these poles in order to apply it. Okay, so let me consider a new function, which I'll call f of s. And it's just the S matrix divided by some other function, h of s, where h has these properties. So first of all, it has the same poles as the S matrix. Okay, and I'm going to define, so the residue of h at those poles, I'll call gh squared. It's just notation. It has no zeros, because of course we don't want to introduce new poles by dividing by h. And it satisfies the constraint that it exactly has unit modulus everywhere along these cuts. Okay. I'm allowed to invent this function. And it turns out that these properties actually uniquely define this function to be the following. And then in the denominator, there's the same, but with a minus sign. Okay, so now what are the properties of this function f? So first of all, f satisfies the same unitarity condition as s because of this property on h, okay? And furthermore, it has no poles. So in other words, we know that the modulus of f is less than or equal to 1 on the boundary, but by maximum modulus theorem, then it's less than or equal to 1 everywhere inside the domain. Okay? In particular, it's less than or equal to 1 here at the position of the pole in S. So what does this imply? So F, the modulus of F at M2 at the pole, M2 squared, it's equal to G112 squared divided by GH squared. Okay, and it's less than or equal to 1. But we know GH. GH we extract just from taking the residue of this function. So then this gives us our bound. It tells us, I'll just write it here. So in other words, G112 squared is less than GH squared. Okay, and GH is some analytic function which we know. It's something like M2 cubed. This just, again, comes from directly extracting the residue. 4m2. Okay, so this is our first example of an analytic bound. Of course, as I said before, it depends on the mass of the particle that you're exchanging. And what does it look like? So we can plot this guy. Let's plot it here. So here I have G112 squared. Let me mark some important points on the plot. So this will be this will be when M2 equals M2 squared equals twice M1 squared. Just go ahead and erase this. And then, of course, we can't go below M2 squared equals M1 squared because we've assumed that M1, the external particle, is the lightest guy.
Did you set M1 equals 1 there?
Yes, probably. Yeah, okay. So let's just do that throughout the rest of the talk. In fact, let's measure everything in units of M1 because otherwise it's going to be a disaster keeping track of it. Okay, and then this edge of the plot is M2 squared equals 4, okay? So twice the mass of the two particle state squared of 2 ones. So basically, when you start here in this right corner, this is a very weakly bound state, okay? Because it's telling you that really M2 has really exactly twice the mass of 2M1. So it's just a very weakly bound state. So couplings in a theory like that can't be very strong. And indeed, this bound vanishes there. And then following our intuition, as we decrease the mass of M2, so we're increasing the binding energy, the bound on G goes up. And it could go up and go up and go up. And then at this point where M2 is twice the mass of M1 squared, it diverges. And what's happening there is just that these two poles are colliding with each other. And the S-channel pole and the T-channel pole have opposite residues. So they're just screening each other. And at that point, you can't get any bound. Okay, that's the reason we get this divergence. Then you can continue on the other side. And something kind of strange happens, which is that the bound comes back down, which is not super intuitive, but that's what happens. And in fact, there's a symmetry about this point, and it just really comes from the symmetry of this diagram that once you've interchanged these two poles, you essentially end up back where you were before. Okay, now you can ask, is there the possibility of any theory living on this curve? Okay, and it turns out that there is, and in this particular case, it turns out to be Sine-Gordon. So Sine-Gordon is some theory, it has some kinks in it. These kinks can form breathers. And this S matrix that I wrote before, which I now erased, unfortunately, corresponds exactly to the scattering of two breathers. Okay. Let me clarify that point quickly. So as I said, this, I can write it. Yeah, we don't need these properties anymore. So we had some h of s, which I won't write again, but it was some explicit function. And there's something about this maximum modulus theorem tells us more than just that the maximum of the modulus occurs on the boundary. It also tells you you can't have any local maxima of the modulus inside. Okay. So if you have a point where G112 exactly equals the bound, okay, which is saying that f equals 1 inside the domain, it's telling you that actually f equals 1 everywhere. All right? And so that just tells us that the S matrix, which maximizes the bound, is exactly this function h of s. So what I'm saying is that this h of s, which is our maximizing S matrix, is exactly the S matrix of scattering the lightest breathers in Sine-Gordon theory. Okay, and this hints at another interesting property of this solution, which is remember that this function satisfied this equality, right? That exactly saturates unitarity on the whole boundary. Okay, and that's, of course, related to the fact that we find this Sine-Gordon model sitting here. Sine-Gordon is known to be an integrable theory, which means that you can't have any particle production. Okay, the 2-to-2 amplitudes, they saturate unitarity because, I mean, integrability tells you you can't go into anything else. Okay. And this will be important later because eventually, you know, and especially in higher dimensions, we want to, you know, we want to be able to study non-integrable theories, right? Theories where, we don't always want to have integrable theories sitting on our bounds, right? We want to have more interesting physical theories that sit on the bound. Okay, so we're going to need some way to fix this. I mean, if you want to call it a problem, but to essentially create some situation where you don't have unitarity saturation. And so I'll come back to that in a minute, but what I want to talk about before that is how to solve this problem in a slightly different way, which will generalize nicely to more complicated situations. So in other words, we're going to do this same problem numerically. You can ignore that top board for now because it will be important later. So just explain how to solve this problem numerically, and then later when we do more complicated things, it will be the numerics we'll be using. So we have this function, this S matrix, S of S. Okay, let me say that I remove the poles. All right. So if I think about what a dispersion relation for this S of S would look like, it tells us that I have a function which has a T cut plus a function which has an S cut. Okay. Now, how do I parameterize a function like this? Analytic everywhere except some cut. A nice way to do it is to change to a set of coordinates, let me call it rho of s, that maps this whole thing to the disk, okay? Where this top part of the cut goes to the top of the disk, and the bottom part of the cut goes to the bottom of the disk. And what's nice about this is that now I can parametrize a function with this cut just by a Taylor series in this variable rho. Because by assumption, there's no singularities inside this disk, so a Taylor series in rho will converge. Okay? And so I can parametrize a function with this cut in the same way. I just need to use rho of 4 minus s. And I get the same disk. So what this means is that I can take now my S matrix, which I'll say equals poles plus some, just sums over these rows. Okay, so I have some coefficients, and I have rho of s, and I have rho of 4 minus s. And the fact that I use the same coefficient for both is just crossing symmetry for this case, right? This function has to be symmetric under interchanging s and 4 minus s. OK, and now it's very simple to turn this into a numerical problem. First, you just you set some n. Ah, sorry. Yeah, thanks. OK, so some Taylor series in this variable rho. So now it's very simple to turn this into a numerical problem. We just truncate this infinite upper limit, okay, and we discretize unitarity. So because the top of the cut maps to this part, right, I discretize the top of the disk, I have some row I's, and I just say that s at each row I is less than or equal to 1, and I do it for each row I. This gives me a list of quadratic constraints. These are just quadratic constraints in these parameters an and in the residues of the poles. And now this is a very simple numerical problem. You basically just, there are many types of algorithms that will do this. They'll take some set of quadratic constraints that contain some parameters, and you say, what is the biggest value of this parameter subject to these quadratic constraints? Okay, so this is just, for example, there's some program find maximum in Mathematica, which does it. And it will give you, as an output, the values of all these coefficients, which are optimal. Okay, so you can do this. You can take these and compare with the exact solution, and it agrees per. Like, I won't have time to show that, but it's just to say that, you know, this numerical approach is quite simple and it gives the right answer. Okay. So now I'd like to move on to, I'd like to come back to this issue of how can we start studying not just integrable theories. I mean, of course, the bounds that we have, they apply generally, right? But we want to be able to have interesting theories that aren't integrable sitting on the bound. This would be our dream. So we need to start, in order to have that, we have to have S matrices that don't saturate unitarity. Okay. So we need to create some situation where you don't saturate unitarity. And the trick to doing that is just to include more terms in the unitarity equation. Okay. And it's a bit more than that, but let me explain. So basically, this is 4, I guess. This is what we call this multiple amplitudes. If you're familiar with CFT bootstrap, this is the equivalent of multiple correlators. Okay, so let's write our unitarity equation in a little more detail. What it actually says is that this process plus the sum of all these processes where 1, 1 can go into other things is less than or equal to 1. Okay. And what can this other stuff be? This other stuff could be, for example, you could go into a 1 and a 2, right? 2 is the next heaviest part. You could go into a 2 and a 2. You could go into 3 1s. Lots of other stuff, okay? So I'm gonna concentrate on this case, right? Studying still 2 to 2 S matrices, but including the effects of heavier particles. But let me just say that this case is being studied, this 2 to 3 case, is being studied by Alex and Pedro. And there's already some interesting results there. But this is much harder, so I'll stay here. OK, good. And so to further simplify things, I'm going to assume that I have some Z2 symmetry. Okay? And my particles 1 and 2, they form some multiplet of that symmetry, where 1 is Z2 odd. and 2 is z to 2 is z. Now you can ask, so now I want to say what are the analytic, so to write my ansatz, my numerical ansatz, right, I need to say what are the analyticity properties of these functions. And that just comes from, again, studying what kind of on-shell processes you have in each type of amplitude. Okay, so let's start with the 1-1 goes to 1-1. Okay, if we look at the tree-level diagrams and we include the Z2 symmetry, you see that you have just these cases, right? You have two 1s that come together, but that's a Z2 even state, so you can only produce a 2. Then you can produce two 1s again. It's the same in the teaching. Okay, 2 to 2 is the same, except that the external state you just replace with 2, right? But you're going to have Z2 even states propagating in the middle. 1-1 goes to 2-2 is more interesting. So in the S channel, you again have 1-1 producing a 2. But in the T channel, now you have a Z2 odd state coming in. So what's propagating is, again, a Z2 odd state. And it's the same in the U channel. So here, because the particle, the initial and final particle masses aren't the same, you can't just exclude the U channel, right? There's forward and backward scattering are no longer identical. You have one where 2 is moving right and one where 2 is moving left. And that's why you have these two channels. Okay, so this tells us where all the poles will be in our ansatz. And now we have to see where do we need to start the cuts in the ansatz. So for that, we should look at the lightest two particle state we can propagate. Again, it's exactly the same sort of logic. You say, I start with two ones coming in. It's a Z2 even state. What's the lightest two particle Z2 even state I can create? It's two ones. Same in the other channel. And then for 1-1 goes to 2-2, you have, for example, in the T channel processes where you have a 1 and a 2, and what propagates in the cross channel is a 1 and a 2. Okay. So for these type of processes, the cut will start at twice the mass of the lightest guy. For this channel, the cut will also start at twice the mass of the lightest guy. But in these channels, the cut will start at M1 plus M2 squared. So that's all encoded in the ansatz that we write. I think maybe there's no string. Okay, so everything I've been saying is now just built into these ansatz. So these poles just come from these tree-level diagrams. And the positions of these cuts come from what the lightest two-particle state is. Okay, so in 1-1 goes to 1-1. We have the same row. The cut starts at twice the mass of the external guy. In 1-1 goes to 2-2, though, in the S channel, we have the same row because the lightest state is 2 ones. But in the T channel, we have some rho tilde. Okay, and this rho tilde is just essentially the same as rho, but it maps the cut plane with the cut starting at M1 plus M2 squared. Okay, so these will have the cross channels, the T and the U channels, will have their cuts starting at the M1 plus M2 squared. Okay. Good. Are there any questions? I'm going really fast, I see. So please tell me if there's anything that's unclear. Okay. So you might think at this point that we're just done, right? We just take this ansatz, we say, okay, where do we apply unitarity? We apply it on a grid. We truncate these sums, and then we get bounds. But it's a little bit harder than that. And the reason, and to see that, you really have to study. I have any space? I guess I don't need this board anymore. You really have to study where unitarity is applying and what it's doing. So let me look at that. And in particular, so actually, I think so let's look at the equation. The idea is that now we have a unitarity equation of this, right? 1-1 goes to 1-1 squared. This is one of the unitarity equations. And we have 1-1 goes to 2-2 squared, and this has to be less than or equal to 1. And so the idea is that if this is not 0, right, then 1-1 goes to 1-1 can't saturate unitarity, and the bound must be low. Okay? And we get closer to having non-integrable models sitting on the bound. But it's not guaranteed that she can't set this to 0. Let me explain why that can happen. Okay, so now I'm drawing the analytic structure of 1-1 goes to 2-2. This is the S plane. So in 1-1 goes to 2-2, in the S channel, you have, of course, the cut starting at 4m1 squared. And also the next cut starts at 4m2 squared. Okay. But you only impose unitarity in its usual form here. Because this is the point where you have enough energy to produce this final state. Which means you have this whole region of the cut, which is unconstrained, naively, by anything. Okay? And so what can happen is that this density here can start to fluctuate really wildly. And you get some crazy densities that look like this. And it can actually completely screen out the effects of these poles. So I should back up a minute and say, first of all, why can't this amplitude be 0? 1-1 goes to 2-2, why can't it just be 0? And it's because this pole that we're maximizing appears there, right? So this G112, we don't want to set it to 0, we want to maximize it. So then you can say, well, if this function has a pole, it can't be 0. But the thing is that if you're not careful, it can actually be 0 in this region where it appears in the unitarity equation. Okay, this is actually sort of a fun electrostatics problem. If you take just electrostatics on a line, and you put a point charge at one point, and then you say, I have some allowed density in this region, rho of x. And you ask, can I make the potential, can I make the electric field 0 over here, given that I can make this density anything? And the thing is that you can. You can make some perfect cloaking device. The density will do something crazy like this, but it will perfectly cancel the monopole, the dipole, the quadrupole. And so that you have really, you can make the field here as small as you want. Okay, and that's exactly what's happening here. So we actually have to dig a bit deeper if we want to get bounds. And the thing is that, it's still a physical state that's propagating here. It's still a physical 1-1 state. And so, there should be some restrictions on the density. And what those restrictions come from is something called extended unitarity. And what extended unitarity tells you is that actually, in a certain sense, you can apply the unitarity equation below the point where you have the energy to produce the external particles. Okay. Let me just explain what I mean by that. So unitarity is SS dagger equals 1. For this purposes, it's better to write in terms of a T matrix, S equals 1 plus IT, where we remove the trivial propagation. And then it becomes minus I T minus T dagger is T T dagger. Okay. So usually we use this by saying that okay, we should sandwich between some external states, and then we insert a complete basis of states here. So I guess I can do it here. So if I want to turn this operator equation into a formula. Functions, I put some external states, and I insert a complete basis here, so I should sum over psi. Okay, and the claim of extended unitarity is that, well, while here you should only sum over physical states, right, states that have enough energy to propagate, you don't need to worry about the energy of the external states. You can use this formula all the way down to S equals 0. And an example of that is if you impose it below the point where you have the energy for anything to propagate, right? What it will tell you, this left-hand side becomes, in general, it's twice the imaginary part of this T A goes to B. Okay. Here, actually, to make this step, you have to assume some parity and time reversal symmetry. But let's do that. And it tells, so if you apply this below where you have no size, they can propagate, right? It will just tell you this imaginary part equals 0, and you recover the usual statement of real analyticity, which is something that, right, this is just telling you that you can't have a cut starting before you have on-shell states that can propagate. Okay, so this is something that looks funny, but we'll use it. And if you want to know, I mean, where this comes from is studying the consistency of higher point functions, like 4-to-4 scattering, and going to factorization points where these 2-to-2 amplitudes appear evaluated at these energies. Okay, so it's not a trivial thing, but it's something handed down to us from the brilliant people working on these things in the 60s. So let's see how it saves us. So the particular amplitude we want to look at is we want A to be equal to 2, 2, and B to be equal to 1, 1. Okay. And this gives us an equation like, of course, just so it will tell us that twice the imaginary part of T 1, 1 goes to 2, 2 is equal to 2, 2, and then we have T, T dagger, 1, 1. So now I'm going to use something just a simple mathematical identity called Schwarz identity. Let me call this state A and this state B. And there's this nice identity, which we usually learn in quantum mechanics, that tells us A, B squared is less than or equal to A, B, B. So if I just apply that to this equation, what I get is that the imaginary part of T11 goes to 22 is less than or equal to the imaginary part of T11 going into 11 and T22 going into 22. Imaginary part. Yeah, I should square. Thanks, Ben. So what does this do? What it does is it tells us that actually this thing can't fluctuate as wildly as it wants. It actually has some envelope which bounds this. Okay. And while this envelope is something which you find dynamically, it comes from the other amplitudes that are also being found during this optimization procedure, but it doesn't allow this thing to fluctuate as much as it wants. And basically, it prevents you from screening. Okay? You can no longer have a non-zero process here. Okay, so at the end of the day, you end up with, where did it go? Boards all over the place. Ah, yeah. So at the end of the day, you have that this is not equal to zero. And you're really going to lower your bound, okay? But this has also pointed out another important ingredient in considering more than one particle, which is that, so what kind of unitarity equation was this? It was an off-diagonal unitarity equation, right? It was the unitary equation for 1, 1 goes to 2, 2. So it's telling you that actually off-diagonal unitarity, when you have more than one particle, which is when you have off, I mean, it's that it's quite important, right? So actually we should, and it can be, you know, we don't only need to use it. Here I've explained only using it here in this region where we need it, but it could also be imposed here, right? This is a, this equation comes from a diagonal unitarity equation, right? But we should impose all of the constraints coming from unitarity, including off diagonal, for all the energies that we can. So how do we do that? So unitarity again, it's this equation, SS dagger equals 1. And what you can show is that what this implies, if you project onto some subspace of particles, so for example, 2 to 2 part, like the 2 to 2 subspace, it tells you that 1 minus this projected S matrix is positive semidefinite. Okay. This is just a natural, I mean, this is just saying that if, you know, within this subspace, you have the chance of not being equal to 1, right? Because you have other states that you can go into. This is just the natural matrix generalization of these equations that I was writing here, this diagonal unitarity equation. Okay. So now it's a very simple problem to translate into numerics, to include this extended unitarity, this off-diagonal unitarity. It's like, so I should say actually that this problem of imposing that you have some matrix which is positive semi-definite, so saying I want to optimize some parameter subject to a constraint that I have some matrices which are positive semi-definite, it's a standard technique in mathematics, which is just called semi-definite programming. OK? Okay. So let me, we're going to make use of that. Let me just explain what the numerical setup is like. So we have this, these four thresholds. We have four M1 squared. We have M1 plus M2 squared. We have four M2 squared. Okay. So here in this first interval, we're going to impose, among other things, that S11 goes to 11 squared is less than or equal to 1. In this interval, now we have to impose that this matrix is positive semi-definite, where this SP is the projection onto the states that can flow here. Well, it's you have to consider what states that can flow there to write it. Oh, actually, I'm writing what I already have on this board. Yeah. Okay, so this is just what I was writing over there. Now I don't have to write it all. So again, in this first interval, we have that this, what we can say is that this single component is less than one. In this next interval, we need to impose that this matrix, right, is positive semi, or well, we have SP, right? We need to impose that this matrix is positive semi-definite, but with this SP. Okay, and that's because the states that can flow are 1, 1, 1, 2, and then this 2, 1, which is just the two, you know, 1, 2 and 2, 1 are just the two states where two is either moving right or left. Okay. And then finally, in this interval above the last threshold, we impose that this full, the full two-particle subspace, this matrix, one plugged into here, is positive semi-definite. And then finally, in addition to all of that, we need to impose this Schwarz condition in this range. Okay. And once you do all of that, you take your ansatz. You take this ansatz, you plug it into this, these matrices, and you turn the crank, and you get some bounds. So actually, we have these things running on the cluster as we speak. And I have actually only one result at the moment, which I'll, I guess I don't need much space on the blackboard for it. So,
sorry, John.
Tell me.
Is it obvious that this Schwarz constraint, why doesn't it apply? Why does it only apply in some finite region?
No, good question. So it applies everywhere, but it's equivalent. This will contain it above this point. So it will just be built in here. But you see that 2, 2 goes to 2, 2 doesn't appear in this matrix, nor here. Sorry, 1, 1 goes to 2, 2 doesn't appear here or here. So you really need to impose this extra constraint to get this envelope. So for example, one data point that we have already is that if I have for the value M2 squared equals, like, say, 1 plus 2 tenths. Well, I'll just say M2 is 1 plus 2 tenths. Okay, so this one is mass of M1 equals 1, of course. Then the optimal coupling, G1, 1, 2, once you include all these constraints, is something around 5.12. And if you want to compare with what CDD was giving for these values, or sorry, not C, I shouldn't say CDD, I should say this, the result from this boy model, the sine Gordon, it was that before was something around 13.1. Okay, so we've lowered this bound already by more than a factor of 2 for this particular, for models that have these particular spectrum. Okay. So, are there questions? I have some time left, so I can talk about more things, unless people want to ask questions about what I've said.
Yeah, I had a question about the numerics.
Sure.
So you're taking always some n max in these.
Yes.
Some. So is there some physical understanding how things converge as n max goes to infinity?
How what converges?
How the results converge as n max goes to infinity?
I mean, the one thing that we do have an understanding of is that, I guess I erased the numerics board, is that if you have singularities sitting on the boundary of this disk, so we know that we have no singularities in the disk, okay? But there are examples where, I mean, this is in higher dimensions, but there are examples where you can have singularities sitting right here, like a threshold. This would be where s equals 4m squared. Or also at infinity. Actually, yeah, we have examples even of this in 1 plus 1. So if you have these sort of singularities sitting on the boundary of the disk, the convergence can be very slow. Okay? Or if you don't have, you know, you need to make sure your ansatz meets all of the requirements, right? That it has a general enough asymptotic behavior and all of this stuff. Right? And in those cases, the convergence is quite fast. It's like already by n equals 6, you see pretty much the final result up to a decimal place or two. When you start to see really slow convergence, it means that you have a problem with one of these things. Either there's some singularity sitting on right on the boundary of the disk, like a pole. Well, it can't be a pole, but in higher dimensions, it could be like 1 over square root of a pole. Square root of a pole. Or some problem with your asymptotic behavior, then you can see really slow convergence. In these cases, I see, like in this case, by n equals 10, I already had quite good even I could have probably written another decimal place here. So that's basically what we could say about convergence. Other questions? Okay. So then I do have time then to talk about higher dimensions, unless there's something else that I want to talk about related to lower dimensions. Okay, good. We'll talk about higher dimensions. So in higher dimensions, this stuff all carries over pretty nicely, except that we have to make some... So let me first say that in higher dimensions, we're not anywhere near doing multiple correlators yet. We're still doing just the single amplitude. So there, you should, of course, include... for one, it's better... always in higher dimensions to use t instead of s. You should include, let me just get rid of these, you should include a u-channel pole. Let me just call everything m squared. And so now the first thing is that, again, we have this argument that we have a function, it has an s-cut, a t-cut, and a u-cut. It's very easy to parameterize that. We just write now a sum, this is plus. Write a sum over n, n l of okay, so now I have a function, and so this has a function with all the cuts in the right places, the right poles. I want to impose crossing. That's simple. This scattering process of neutral scalar in higher dimensions, crossing will just tell you that it's a symmetric function of s, t, and u. So you can really permute s, t, and u, and you get the same process. So it just tells you that these coefficients are symmetric. So now I have crossing and analyticity built in. Finally, I should, of course, restrict to this ansatz to the physical surface, right? I should restrict to s plus t plus u equals 4m squared, but that's okay. And now the big difference with higher dimensions is in unitarity, right? And now, if you want to impose unitarity, the easiest way to do it is to go to partial waves. So I have to project this T matrix onto its partial waves and then impose unitarity on each of the partial waves. I'll write it in four dimensions, but it's more or less the same formula that holds in higher dimensions. In four dimensions, this is a Legendre polynomial that's sitting here, and you have just t. So here x. So I have s and x. This x is just the scattering angle, cosine theta, okay, which is just a parameterization which makes this automatic. Okay. It's just some function. It's like t plus u over t minus u, I think, something like that. So once you have these partial waves, you do exactly the same thing. You impose E, well, you impose that this thing evaluated on the physical region squared is less than or equal to 1. And now you just have two cutoffs, right? You should say that you impose it, you have a grid of S points. So you have for some Si, and you also impose it for L equals 1 up to some large L cutoff. And of course, you have to truncate this sum at some n max. Okay. And after you do all these things, you just again, you these unitarity equations are just a set of quadratic constraints, and you optimize the value of this parameter subject to them. So there's a few different different games that you can play. One is really just purely this setup maximizing g squared. And so let me make the same plot that I had before, which turned out to be Sangordan, and of course won't be in this case, squared. So again, we find some bound which vanishes right at the right corner, and that makes sense again because the same non-relativistic analysis is going to apply there. You have a very weakly bound state, interactions can't be very strong. The way it vanishes is slightly different. It vanishes with a different power, with a different coefficient, but those are things that can actually be predicted non-relativistically, and our bound matches that. Then it goes up, and it has some large peak somewhere right around 2. Okay, so this is where the mass of the bound state propagating is, so I'm plotting here m squared. This is the mass of the bound state. So the mass squared of the bound state. So the actual mass is square root of 2. And then it comes down, and actually on this side of the plot, the convergence is kind of very poor. So these are, I'm drawing now the lines for several different values of this n max. Okay, you always have to make sure as you get these bounds that as you increase n max, you have the same bound. Okay. Actually, the poorness starts a little bit later. It's more like over here. And of course, you can't go past 1, because again, you've assumed that 1 is your lightest part. Okay. And I wish I could put some values on this plot, but because I didn't prepare to talk about this, I didn't. But I'll end there. People can ask whatever questions they want about these things. So thank you.
Any further questions? Comments?
Yeah, so where does this process C about the dimension of space-time? So I guess the Legendre polynomials?
Yeah, there's some, in general, there's some Jacobian here and some different function here.
But rho is...
Rho is rho. I mean, it's just, the cuts are the same in any dimension. So, so for example, we made the same plots in 2 plus 1, and it's quite similar, right?
There's something special happening, say, in a large D limit.
We haven't looked. Yeah, I haven't.
Okay, I don't know further questions. Let's thank the speaker again.